Okay. Just remind everyone while we're before we get started, we're HMTRI. We do these little conference calls around 30 minutes apiece every 2 weeks. We do 10 of them in a cycle, and this is the third one of this cycle. We had Flint, Michigan on, and we had Cypress Mandela this week. This cycle we're going through all of our great grantees, and they all have special situations and the things they're doing. They've got a lot of experience, and we're listening to their story, what they're doing, and getting some great peer-to-peer mentoring going on. HMTRI is, of course, we've been around since the beginning of Brownfields, and we don't have a worker training grant, but we've worked with them since the beginning of the program. What I might mention before we get too far into this is if you're on a speakerphone, if you can mute your line or come take it off the speaker, because we'll get background. These earphones are so sensitive now, it's easy to pick everything up in the room. So we like to keep an open mic for everyone, but that is the downside of that. We usually, we don't speak for EPA, but we've been close to them for such a long time, and we've worked with all the grantees since the beginning of the program. And we always like to put the caveat in, we don't speak for EPA, and all the guests don't speak for them either, but they tell us what they've been doing, talk to us, and it's a chance to answer questions that we might have. And we'll be sending out post-session notes. If you don't get post-session notes, go to msenyu@aol.com and just let me know. We usually send them out by Friday. That's msenew@aol.com. Often, we have about 350 on our participant list, but often we'll get rejects or bounces, or it might go into someone's spam box or something. So for some reason, if you don't get it, or if you're not getting them, just email me, and we'll double-check why you're not getting them. We do make announcements, and again, every 2 weeks, so we'll be having another one in 2 weeks from now, same time, same place, same phone number. We also always start with news from Washington. And Glo, anything today?
Well, I talked to Rachel this morning. She told me that they were still on track for making the new grantee announcements for FY16 in May. She's trying to firm up a date for the announcement and doesn't have one yet, but said that she would let me know as soon as they have that date.
Right.
That was all that she had to say. Then the other reminder then from HMTRI would be on the grantee meeting. The all grantee annual meeting will be August 17th and 18th. PLC members that are active in the PLC are invited to attend. Through our cooperative agreement with the EPA, there is no fee to attend the workshop, and we will pay for the hotel room for 3 nights for people from out of town. So the only thing that's left for the participant to pay for would be the travel and any extra meals that they might have. The hotel deadline is July 26th, so if you plan to attend, register before that date so that you can get your hotel reservation made before they cut us off. That's it for me, Mike.
Great. I'll put in the post-session notes a few other conferences that are going to be occurring. Usually this is a quiet time, but then summer things start to pick up. In addition to the annual grantee meeting, which those of you like Guy that might be on the line, it's a great thing to go to because you have all the grantees there, all the EPA regional coordinators. We've got EPA staff, assistant administrators, and it's like a little boot camp for 2 days where we talk all about the issues of running a program, pretty much a long version of these PLC calls. In August, there's a couple of the Southeast is very active in Brownfields associations. There's a Georgia Environmental Conference in late August, and then the Florida Brownfields Association, which we'll be talking about later in October. And these are great meetings. And I always remind people, if there's a Brownfields Association in your area, get in touch with them. They're great to send people to, or your graduates or participants, because all of the stakeholders in that state usually join those, all the consultants. And it's a great way to do a needs assessment. When you're at the Florida Brownfields Association, there's about 400 people, all contractors and people who need people to do the work, attend. and they have sessions often. Some states are more active than others. When we find them, we'll publish them to remind you. But you don't have to be in the state that the Brownfields Association is in, because often these contractors are nationwide. For example, the Florida one, it covers the whole southeastern region and beyond that. And a lot of the contractors that are there cover the whole country. So it's a great place to go to make some contacts. And one time Florida, Florida State participated and sent some of their graduates to that program. So it's a great thing to go to. There's also another thing I'll put in the post-session notes. It's a small grant opportunity, an environmental education program in EPA. It's a very small grant. It's mostly for awareness, but it fits well with our grantees. These are EPA awareness grants. It's about $3 million a year, and they divide it up by region. And they give out these small grants, $25,000, $30,000, $5,000, to do things like fairs, awareness evenings, poster sessions, and the regional ones. Each regional gets a group of them. It's a nice thing you can get a hold of and do posters or do an awareness night, that type of thing. But I'll put the announcement in the post session notes. The only other thing that I would say before we talk to Florida State of Jacksonville is to make sure those of you who have submitted grant proposals, make sure that you keep aware of your partners. Just touch base with them and say the same thing we just said, that the announcement will probably be made in May. They're well along, I believe, on their evaluation process, because I know they're into it, because our coordinators who often attend some of these PLCs say they can't make it because they're involved in these programs. So they're evaluating right now. And what goes along with that is there is a possibility they might call your partners, particularly if you've mentioned them particularly if they've given them a phone number or contact information. They might contact them and ask what their involvement is in your program. And if they don't know anything about it, you're in trouble. So it's good to touch base with them. Just say, we want to let you know where we're on the schedule. More importantly, or also importantly, is remind them that, you know, there's about 60 people competing for this. We may or may not get it this year, particularly if you're a first-year grantee. But the next round will be in November, which is a short time away. And if for some reason we don't get it, the fact is we want to keep our group together. We want to consult with our regional coordinator and expand our grant for the next round. So you want to keep your team together and expand it. So it's not one of those things you get it or you don't get it and that's forever. Many of our grantees get it on the second or third try. So you want to keep your group together. You want to keep them informed and keep on rolling with that. So just a couple of reminders that we'll also put in post-session notes. Today, it's really Florida State of Jacksonville is one of our stars. They've had four grants. They started with a stimulus grant in 2009, but then they got another grant in 2011, another one in 2013, 2015. Now, about half the grants that are awarded go to previous grantees. It's not set in stone. It's always based on the quality of your grant proposal. So out of 13 or 14 grants, you might get six or seven re-ups, I call them, and then some six or seven new grantees. But it's competitive, and it's hard even for existing grantees to get re-upped. And here we've got a school that's been re-upped four times. And that's not by accident. It's because they have a great program, and they're hitting on all cylinders. And I remember when the first controversy came up when they had to go to Kathleen Curry in the region and Region 4 and convince them that we can use tablets. And they had to prove that this was cost effective. And, you know, they had never been done before. How are you going to do it? Where are you going to get your curriculum? at that time, oh, this is going to be really expensive. And so they did the hard work. They did all of the cost analysis. They looked at the effectiveness. They researched out all the different approaches, and they convinced the region to give them a try. And they've been going ever since. But in addition to their tablets, their recruitment and their program and their graduates are just awesome. So with that, I'd like to turn it over to Jorge and introduce himself and tell us about your program.
Okay, thank you for the introduction. My name is Jorge Gutierrez, working here at Florida State College at Jacksonville. I took over the program about a year and a few months ago. Sarah Ashbrook and Pam had really put together a really good program. I was very lucky to have been able to follow in their footsteps and in the process and improve some of the processes that they've been that they established in the beginning. One of the more important things is, like what you said, the tablets. We were using the Nook tablet, buying from Barnes and Noble. They were about $100, and they stopped selling those and converted to a Samsung Galaxy 4. If they call it still a Nook, but it's a 7-inch tablet onto which we upload all of the PowerPoints, all of the study guides, all of the instructor notes, all of the important notes that the instructors want for each one of our classes. Now, all of our class, I mean, I think we have got 22 different modules. In a 16-week period, we have 22 different modules. And therefore, we have 22 different, well, we have more than 22 folders, but 22 folders for each class. The instructions are that the students will review the materials for the class prior to coming to class. It's kind of like when we all went to college where, you know, you have to be prepared before you go to class and rather than just expect the instructor to pour it all in. So we find that our students come to class much more prepared, much more readily able to absorb the information because they've done some review prior to. One of the other advantages to having the tablets is that they're Wi-Fi capable. So once they walk on campus or, you know, anywhere in the city where they can catch on to Wi-Fi, they're able to get on the internet, and we encourage them and we show them how to access Wiser and how, and learn to use Wiser so that they could become very well versed on using Wiser to identify chemicals and whatever else. In addition to that, I have usually assigned one of our students to do a presentation towards the end of the term about Wiser. And what I notice is all the students in the class already know and understand what that person's talking about. The first time when I first got there, they all seemed a little sketchy. They didn't understand what was being told to them until I start to emphasize them learning to use Wiser, using the tablet for that. And now it just seems like they're all speaking the same language because they're all using the same tools. When they come to class, of course, let's say they're doing the general industry OSHA safety class. In addition to the books, they've got all the PowerPoints that the instructor is going to show on the overhead. They've already looked at those, and they're able to follow along a lot easier. The book work is a little easier to do. Another reason our program, I think, is so successful is because our facilities are state of the art. We've got a large classroom with all of our gear, including the self-contained hazmat suits and the tanks, and of course, you know, these tabs with posters that show them how to use everything. So, and I don't know if you all know, but our higher rate so far is 83%. We think we prepare them as much as possible to get into the workforce and be productive in the workforce. And a big part of that is these tablets that then they can take with them. When they graduate from the program, they can take the tablets with them. And our hope is that because all their notes, all the study guides, all the PowerPoints for each one of our modules are in there. So if they need to refer to anything, it's at a finger away from fingertip click to access and review whatever they might need. And they're able to use Wiser when they're out in the field. It's really a good program, and I think it's enhanced by the use of those tablets. Anybody have any questions?
No. So you're actually using it as an adjunct to your regular curriculum. Is that correct?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
One of the questions we've had over the years is getting curriculum. Now, you're part of a Florida State College, so you've got professors who have done this curriculum. A lot of it's in PDF format, right? And
yeah.
Wiser is a chemical analysis tool, isn't it? That's put out by one of the governmental, or is that a chemical nonprofit, or is that the federal? I don't know. That's a good tool for identification of pollutants.
Chemicals
and pollutants.
Yeah, that class starts with a video of a, and I'm not sure if you all have seen it, of a police officer pulling up to an accident where a chemical truck is spilled over and there's a body laying beside it. And this is dash cam video, and then the police officer hops out of his car, goes to assist, and then falls over and dies. Had he had Wiser and known how to use it, that wouldn't have happened. So that's how we start that particular class, because the Wiser is able to identify and tell you all the dangers of whatever chemical anybody may come in contact with.
Now, what does your curriculum? I noticed you do RRP and you do some stormwater. Is that correct? And some pesticide.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Oh, we have 22 different modules.
Oh, okay.
Let's see. Construction safety is the 30-hour. We do fall protection. That's 10 hours. We do oil spill disaster site worker and supervisor, all of the FEMA classes, confined space, industrial hygiene, fire extinguisher safety, all the first aid and CPR. And then there's arc flash, asbestos, lead, mold. We do hazmat, the 24-hour hazmat technician. 30 hours of maritime safety, because we have a large port where a lot of our graduates go to work. And, of course, the HAZWOPR.
Many of these curricula are online. Some NIHS has a lot of it. OSHA has a wealth of information. It does take a certain amount of investment on your instructors, I expect. Now, do those come from the school? Are those adjuncts that you're using from the school?
No, we hire them ourselves.
Oh.
We hire and fire our instructors.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and they're all industry experts. A lot of them, all of them, are in the safety field or in the environmental remediation field, and they're actually out there working, which is why it works out very nicely that all of our classes are in the evening, because they can work, our students can look for work and prepare, and they get real life experience. Our instructors are up to date because they need to be for their jobs. So if any changes occur, they're already on top of it.
Tell us a little bit about your classes. Now, last week we talked to Art, and he said, well, we want to replicate the work environment. So we go 16 weeks. He's got this intensive program. We go from, 8 to 5, simulate the workday. But everyone's got a different model, and part of what we're trying to do with these professional learning community calls is examine all the different models. Now, yours is quite different, and it's used by other grantees too. Now, there are a lot of people, the big criticism of arts program is, well, these people have to support themselves, and they may need a part-time job or they're working. So you're addressing that issue of, you're not simulating the workday, but you're providing evening classes. Now, how does your schedule work out that way?
Classes start from 5 o'clock in the evening. They go on till 10, 4 nights a week, Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, and Thursday. When they come to the program, they're unemployed or underemployed. So we don't put anybody in who's already working unless they're working a really bad part-time job at a restaurant or something, some fast food restaurant, something like that. So most of them are in need of new skills, upgrades, new training.
And I was looking at your criteria. You kind of do a kind of a tryout, don't you? And they have to come to several awareness nights?
In addition to filling out the paperwork, the initial application for non-credit classes here at the college, and I ask them to bring it in, and then I go through a couple of interviews, one on the phone and then one face-to-face. And if we get the opportunity, we'll do a panel just to see how they handle themselves. But typically, it's just a one-on-one interviews. As you can imagine, we have many more applicants than we have seats available for any class. So, yeah, I try to choose according to the interviews, according to the paperwork, according to their backgrounds and their obviously their drug screenings.
I noticed you do a drug screen, and your TAB to qualify isn't real high. It's what is about sixth grade level. Well, that's often a question that people ask.
Yeah, I try to make sure that they all have a high school diploma or a GED.
Mm-hmm.
If they don't have a high school diploma or a GED and are fairly well spoken and they write nice, and I ask, I have them read things because there's a lot of paperwork involved. And if that all washes out, I haven't been a GED instructor for several years. One thing I know is that somebody with a high school diploma and somebody without a high school diploma that should have graduated on the same year, a few years later, is really the same person.
Mm-hmm.
There's no – I always told them that life teaches you an awful lot.
Right.
So there's not a whole lot of difference between somebody with a high school diploma, somebody without a high school diploma several years after high school. And that, I think, and maybe it's hubris, but I think I could spot that, and we'll let them in so long as they enroll into our GED program, as long as they're working towards the GED program, or at least take the TAPE test, and we can see the TAPE test, and you see the TAPE test, and it says, they've got a ninth grade level. That's almost close to passing the GED right there.
Mm-hmm.
So, we do try to make sure that they're going to understand the information, be able to read the books because they are fairly complex. They're not scaled down according to grade level. They're industry standard. Mm-hmm. So we need to make sure that they're able to absorb that information.
I have the feeling that you do what all of our best grantees do, is your basic criteria is desire to finish that program and to start a new career. That kind of trumps everything else, doesn't it?
No, that's true. That's true. It's absolutely true. I ask them several times through the initial recruiting process what their plans are after they get the certification. When they complete the program, what are your plans then? What kind of work? And when they first approach me about the program, I ask them, what do you know about the program? What do you hope to, and then what do you hope to do with that? And what kind of work have you done in the past? And what kind of work do you want to do in the future? And I've turned people away because they've talked about wanting to do graphic design or something like that. Well, you know, it's not really what we're, you know, it's not really, yeah, but I just need a job right now.
Yeah.
But it's not like what you're, you know, so we do try to make sure that we get a good fit and that they do have the mindset to go to work in what I always say is it's a dirty industry. You might be out there doing environmental cleanup. If there's a disaster, then we're going to hopefully send you on deployment to the disaster site where you'll assist and work 12, 13 hours a day for 6 or 7 days a week for a few months until it's cleaned up. Are you know, is that something? And some people, you know, wash out just with that because that's not what I was thinking about. Or, you know, I'll ask them if they're interested in working at the port or maybe in the warehouse or maybe in a manufacturing industry or working in environmental remediation, because we have several brownfield sites here in the area, and we work with several environmental remediation companies that like to hire our people, but, you know, they have to be able to and willing to maybe get dirty, maybe work around hazardous materials, maybe come into contact with mold and asbestos and stormwater and that sort of thing.
It's more of a construction job than it is a desk job.
And
you're
I make
be out
sure that
there.
They understand that, yeah.
Yeah, we find that if you get people, and you've got a really good retention rate too, don't you? Your placement rate has always been up there.
Mm-hmm.
But do you feel your retention rate is pretty good?
It is because, since I've been here, I send out job leads to all 360-plus graduates. And then I ask, and I think I've built a nice relationship with most of them where, you know, they start thanking me for sending them the job leads. And then I ask them if they would, you know, if you accept the job, just let me know. If you're looking for work, let me know. If you're not looking for work, let me know. But pass the job leads to somebody else that you think you know might want it. And that way I get recruitment assistance.
This is a neat thing about your using these tablets. You could establish a network of graduates through email. Is that how you keep in touch with them?
Yeah. Best way to keep in touch with them is through email. And most of them, as you can imagine, most people nowadays are fairly comfortable with technology. Some aren't, and then they become acquainted with it through the tablet.
Well, they'll change other things. They may change their phone number. They'll move, but they'll keep that email.
Right.
So it's a good way to keep in touch
with
them.
So I think our retention rate is really good because I don't get a whole lot of feedback from people who are dropping one job and going to the next one.
Mm-hmm.
But in the environmental field, if there's if there are people who go directly into the environmental field. As soon as that job's over, they're out of a job until they find something else.
Right.
But those are the ones that they get real hot on the next thing, and they go right to work, and then they tell me. So
That's a really good reason for having that email network of all your graduates. And your graduates will generate, if they're working for someone and the boss says, I need people, but now they could send it to you, and you can broadcast it to everyone else.
And that does happen.
That does happen.
Yeah. So they send me job leads, and then they send me recruits for the program.
Okay. That just comes up to another question I had is, do you use the WIB much, or do you not need it, the Workforce Investment Board or the Job Center?
Oh, absolutely. I used to actually work with the local Workforce Development Board.
Oh.
That's where I came from. So I'm invited to all their job fairs, recruitment events. Anytime, like for instance, when GE first came to town here, they had a manufacturing facility, and they wanted people. They liked the fact that we provided all these safety certifications, and they took a close look at a lot of our people. But I found out about them first through the Workforce Development Board. Same thing with Budweiser and Anheuser-Busch. They just expanded and needed to hire 100 people. Well, first thing they did is they contacted me because I know them pretty well, and they I told my graduates, and a lot of my graduates went to a lot of the recruiting events to see if they couldn't get hired for that. So I like the fact that I've got a good relationship with the local workforce development board because they alert me before anything happens.
Mm-hmm.
You know, before the general population knows that Anheuser-Busch is hiring, I've already told my people to get prepared.
Yeah, not only that is people don't realize someone like Anheuser-Busch, or it could be UPS, they need people with environmental credentials, and if you've got a credential, bingo, you've saved them time and money.
Right, especially when you're talking about, you know, the chemicals that they may be using and you know, all the hazardous material handling training that we've given them and gear,
mm-hmm.
they're much better employees.
Now, how many cohorts? Do you do two cohorts a year or two?
Two or three.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, two or three. The main ones are, you know, they're intended to be 15 students each. But if, you know, if we have a shortfall, then we'll have a third
mm-hmm.
to fill in the gap.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Now, our program is also approved by VA.
Oh.
So VA will pay for the training of using the post 9/11 or any other funding streams that they might have.
Hmm.
So oftentimes we'll have a that would be the third cohort.
Uh-huh.
And in that cohort is where I'll insert some of the EWDJT students so as to, you know, fill in the, like this time, we ended up with only 13 people in the class. So down two for the first cohort. So I'm going to see if we do a cert class in May,
mm-hmm.
We'll need, I think, six vets in order to fill that class
mm-hmm.
to be able to start it. Then I'll fill it in with another two or three EWD, JT,
mm-hmm.
and then I'll have a class of about eight people who will go through the whole training, and then, you know, my numbers will be where they're supposed to be. So.
That's a great idea. You know, you're the first one to mention that. And that is a great idea of leveraging with VA funding. Great.
Yeah.
And the way you're handling it is neat because you might get VA to cover half the class, but they may not have that many candidates, and you can leverage it with environmental workforce development job training participants.
Yeah, currently, we have three VA-funded students in the class right now and then one self-pay. He
mm-hmm.
came in, he wanted the construction safety, so that was the very first class we put him in, and he goes, I really like this, I need to go through the whole thing.
Mm-hmm.
I know it's 16 weeks long. I told him, well, you know, it's like $2,000
yeah.
to pay for yourself. He's like, okay.
Wow.
<for it. laughs>
Good for you.
Wow.
Good
so how you. Do you, this is Alma in Region 7, and I joined halfway through, but what is this VA funding? I didn't realize they had that.
Yeah, you just have to be approved as a training vendor through the VA,
okay.
And post 9/11 will pay for it. See, we have a whole division that focuses on veterans because we're
mm-hmm.
in Jacksonville and we're a big Navy town.
Got it.
Yeah. So they know how to, I personally don't, I just know how to send them to Danielle. Send them to Danielle Mecker at the Main Street building and they'll take care of it. And they set
so
it all up.
So it's not that you have to compete for a grant with them. It's tied to the individual?
It's been approved academic program
okay.
through the VA.
Jorge has,
okay.
he has identified the two very important groups. One, of course, is the WIB, because the WIB could provide you with training materials. It could train you with boots if you need something. If you qualify under the WIB criteria in some states, they'll provide you all kinds of information. So you've connected with them, and now you've connected with the VA. It's just an excellent approach.
Yeah, and then we've also connected with the Jacksonville Job Corps, and they'll send us a cadre of their students, of their better students who are about to matriculate out of their program. So they send them to us so that we can, in addition to their vocational training they get there, then they come here and they get their certifications, and they should be off to the races. In fact, this training program class, we've got five of their students who are going through the program. They're doing very well, and I'm hoping that those will all be really good hires at the end of their training.
So you're kind of doing a little, you know, what Art does is he has a construction pre-apprentice program, but then he kind of cherry picks some of the more motivated students and then he sends them to the environmental program to get certifications. You're kind of doing that. Someone else is doing some pre-training leverage. Again, it's a leverage training. And
yeah,
then you're taking those.
Somebody else is doing the vocational training and then I give them the certification training.
Mm-hmm.
And then, of course, I encourage them throughout to, you know, since they've been coming to class, that is my big pitch, since they're coming to class four nights a week for 16 weeks, when we're finished with this, they should consider filling out all the financial aid paperwork and consider going to class at least once or twice a week until they finish a degree of some sort, since they're already accustomed to coming to class and being in C for 5 hours at a night. That, you know, one class a night, two classes a week, rather, that shouldn't be too difficult for them. And I found out this Monday that a big handful of our students have already filled out their financial aid paperwork. They've taken the PERT test, and they're really planning on taking classes either through the summer or starting in September. So.
Wow. So what kind of a percentage do you have of the people that go that continue, it's, even if it's just one class a week?
Oh, I don't have that information, but it looks. I think it's about 3 or 4 per
cohort.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah.
That's really good.
Yeah, and that's out of 15 typical student class size. So 3 or 4 that will continue on, and everybody else hopefully is thinking about it. I always tell them, you know, in 2 years you can end up with a degree of some kind, or in 2 years, you know, those 2 years are not going to wait for you. So they'll arrive one way or the other.
Right.
Do you have a degree or not?
But you're right. Once you're used to, like, working during the day and going to school at night, and if you've done that,
just stay with
it.
It's
so much easier to just continue. Yep. Or even if you're just working part-time,
mm-hmm.
or even just going to night school. And, I mean, it's being in the habit of it and having the study skills to stick with something and do the homework and, you know.
Well, and his graduates have 18 certs. You're probably $4,000, $5,000 worth of certifications that an employer does not have to expend on someone, which is great.
Yeah, and one of the things is that we do have an environmental science AS degree that will accept all of our training, and they give them 9 to 12 credit hours. So they get right off the bat, if they go from our program into the environmental science program, they have 12 credit hours to start, 9 to 12 credit hours. And, you know. And,
that's great.
Yeah.
That's a great encouragement, yeah.
Right, yeah.
So how many does it take to get the degree?
Which one? Do you mean
the
environmental
science
degree? Oh.
Uh-huh.
I think that's either a 30 or 60 credit hour. It's a regular college. It's 3 credit hours per class.
Yeah.
So depending on whether they get an AS degree or if they're getting a certification. I know that FSCJ is very big on getting certifications first, and then, you know, they can matriculate that into an AS degree.
What's FSCJ? Sorry.
Florida State College at Jacksonville.
Oh, okay. Got it. Florida
FSCJ,
State
yeah.
College. I have a question. What are your and I'm sorry because I got here late, but if it's a repeat, then I'll just listen to the recording. But what are the 18 certifications that you provide?
We'll put them in a post-session notes. He's got a range of them. Many of them are OSHA, right? And then you've got some Florida certs.
Yeah, the stormwater
right.
is Florida. And then, of course, we're doing the pest management.
Right.
You are
and
doing
that
one. Okay.
That comes through the city extension office.
Okay.
And then there's the EPA classes, which is
the Hazwoper and the
Yeah.
I think you do RRP, don't you? Lead renovation and asbestos.
Absolutely, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Absolutely.
Okay.
And then, of course, there's the EPA hazmat technician,
right.
And then the stormwater. And we teach them soil and water sampling with that class.
And then, of course, OSHA's got a whole lot of them. You can find space, all of this.
Right.
I went to, it was a conference where actually, I think Sarah was there with her. They actually do I don't know if you still do that, a loose leaf notebook, and they present these beautiful certificates in a sleeve. And you open this, and someone could bring this in to their employer, and it's got all these certificates in sleeves. And it's it's really impressive.
It's a portfolio. In fact, we start filling the portfolio after they finish each first class. Like, for instance, the construction safety was the first class that we did this session. So as soon as they finished that class, we printed out their certificates. We sent off for the cards. We had the instructor sign a certificate, and we filled their portfolio. So we keep a running portfolio with all their certs, and then at the end of the training we have a graduation ceremony at which time you present them with the portfolio, and they're all dressed in their regalia, so it's an actual graduation. All their friends and families are in attendance. We'll have a color guard and maybe some singing, and we take pictures.
Wow.
and then the College Foundation awards a $2,500 scholarship to whoever has the highest GPA.
Oh, seriously? Wow.
Yeah.
So they can use that for college. Okay.
Yeah. Well, $2,500 doesn't go very far.
Yeah.
But it does, pay for, it would pay for all of the certification program for the hazardous, the environmental science.
Okay.
So it would pay for that CERT program, and then if they apply for financial aid, it'll pay for the rest of it. And I always tell them, the fact that you're here indicates that you will more than likely receive financial aid.
Got it. Right. Fill paperwork for financial aid. That makes sense.
Any other questions that anyone might have? George, Jorge, is it all right if someone does have a question, they can email you? I'll put your contact information if it's all right with you.
Yeah, please do. I'll be happy to answer any questions you might have.
Can we have your phone too?
I'll put that in there.
Sure.
I'll put his phone and email in there.
I know that you talked first about the tablets. So have all your classes had the tablets or just more recently?
No. When I came into the program about a year and a few months ago, they were already doing the tablets. What I've done with the tablets is I've just added more materials to the folders, arranged the folders better, and just added more meat to the folders. But
got it. And they're able to maintain the service on the tablet so that they can get their email, which is great.
Yeah.
Easier for to communicate. Okay. Wow.
Yeah,
this
then of course there's Wi-Fi everywhere.
That's true. Thank you.
Sarah and Pam, his predecessors, had to convince Kathleen that this was a good idea, and I think it wasn't a slam dunk. I think
I remember her telling us. Yeah. I'm with EPA, Jorge, so I remember her telling us how she kind of resisted on that.
Yeah.
You guys had to convince her.
It's a good word of the wise.
Convincer.
It's a good lesson for the regional coordinators when this happens. Again, no one else has done it, so I'm surprised. But I expect people will as this goes on. Well, we do try to keep these to a half hour, so we cheated a little bit. But, Jorge, this was such an interesting discussion with you. I appreciate you helping us out with this.
Thank you for the opportunity to share.
Okay. Well, we'll talk to you all in a couple of weeks, and we'll
thank
we'll
you, Jorge.
Another grantee. Thank you, Jorge.
Thanks, everyone.
Mm-hmm.
Thanks, everyone. Bye.